Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at a documentary filmmaker's journey. I am your host, Josh Lindsay from the Movie Proposal Podcast. And with us is our documentary filmmaker, Christian Taylor.
Hey there, Josh. Good Hello. Job on that new intro.
No, I almost said first time filmmaker.
I know you did.
It almost came out. And there is no Jason Rugg today. He forgot to pay his internet bill, so he cannot join us. But in his stead, we have the music man himself, Jeff Kurtnecker. How's it going, Jeff?
Hello. Doing well.
Awesome. Awesome. And then also with us is our sound guy, Jason. Hello, Jason.
Hey, hey.
Jason, who doesn't even look like himself because he has longer hair than Elsa on Frozen.
I'll take your word. I don't get the reference, but...
You haven't seen Frozen?
Well, yeah, everyone's seen Frozen, but long hair is long hair, isn't it?
That's true. It is. Go watch Frozen, Jason.
Length of hair.
It's longer than Jeff's hair.
Ding. That's low-hanging fruit, but I'll take it.
If you're not watching this, if you're only listening, Jason's hair is down to his chest and Jeff has none. It's all on his face.
So. Yeah.
So, all right. We want to talk about the short film Grueling Glory today. But before we do that, Christian, do you have a film update for us?
I do. Something actually very exciting. So, thanks to Michelle Coupe, our co-producer in France, and Flavie Poisson, one of our reenactors and PAs that worked on the film, we now have, I think, 3 extra screenings in Normandy during the D-Day week. So we have a very special one on June 2nd, where we're going to have cast and crew and sort of a little party with that. And then we have the Normandy World War II big red carpet event for that film festival. But there are no tickets. They're sold out, which is why we tried to come up with a new event. And then we're partnering with the town of Carentan to do another showing on June 12th. So we'll have 3 that day and probably another reception or something like that. What's so great about this is they were able to work out a deal where we can show the movie in the theater, pay a tax for the film, which is like 10 or 20%, something like that, to the government. And then we'll split the revenue 50-50 with the theater. And they're going to do all the marketing for us. So I think it's a pretty sweet deal. A lot of people there will be able to see the film that they were in. So that's amazing. Hopefully there are some people on Patreon. There's at least one supporter who has paid the high rate in order to be able to go with us to Normandy. So I'm going to reach out to her this week and see if she's interested. We're so thankful for her contribution and would love to have her with us. So, that's the big exciting news this week is we'll start planning that for that trip and figuring out who can go over there with us. And because we were going over there, I also realized this week we had talked about the Brave Dutch and the Brave Dutch being submitted to, Netflix to get funding. And one of the companies that looked at the Brave Dutch, Disney, wanted a sizzle reel. Well, of course, we don't have a sizzle reel for the Brave Dutch. That would involve me spending a lot of money to do that. And we don't have that at the moment. And so we have this other project, Carentan, Unlocking the Key to Liberty. And it dawned on me that we could conceivably shoot a short sizzle reel while we're there this summer. In fact, we can probably put a lot of it together even before we go from the footage that we already have. Tom Rice, one of the veterans that's in Grueling Glory, is also going to be there again. I think he's 101, maybe. We'll be able to interview him. He was actually at the Battle of Carentan around La Barquette. So he can walk us through the fields and talk to us about what he did. And we can interview Denis Vandenbrink, who's the, noted historian about this battle. So talking about low-hanging fruit, this is one of them where we will already be over there. There's a lot of stuff where, individuals are paying for themselves. So hopefully we can shoot some new stuff and create a sizzle reel. And that's already given us a lot to talk about and, some exciting creative stuff to do. So that's where my mind's been this week, sort of balancing all of those projects and figuring out, what's coming up next. And yeah, still no news on Netflix or anyone else watching The Girl Who Wore Freedom. So we're still waiting for somebody to weigh in about that. And yeah, we haven't heard back about The Brave Dutch on that pitch either. The good news is I did talk to Virgil Films and they are interested in the Carentan, you know, Unlocking the Key to Liberty documentary. So that was exciting. We just have to get a sizzle reel and put a package pitch packet together. So there you go.
This sizzle reel makes me think of when it's kind of like the thing, you know, we're like, hey, we'd love to hire you, but you need experience. And you're thinking, well, how can I get experience if someone doesn't hire me? You know, and like, hey, we want to see this film, but you need a sizzle reel. Like, well, someone needs to pay us something. But the good news is often some of the best work comes out of restraints. So when you are limited in funding or time or resources, that's where you get creative. And you've already figured out a solution more or less to create a sizzle reel and on the cheap, and it'll be exciting to see what comes of it.
Yeah. I mean, when I was talking to Virgil Films, the sizzle reel qualifications is really what I was asking them about, because I got this idea of like, well, we already have a lot of sunk costs, you know, we're already going to be over there and the reenactors love doing stuff and don't charge us for that. And so, you know, all that's kind of already in place. So I wanted to know from, you know, from Joe, okay, what does this sizzle reel need to look like? And what he told me was that it needed to be 3 to 5 minutes in length and it needs to show the arc of the story. The people watching the sizzle reel, let's say it's Netflix, they really want to see what we can do. They want to see the style of filmmaking and they want to see a polished piece so that they know what they're investing in. And it makes total sense. So, you know, I just began to realize that we could get a lot done. We already have a lot of archival photos and videos about the Battle of Carentan. We already have some interviews of people that live there. We have a lot in our possession already to work with. And the rest of it really wouldn't cost us anything, interviewing people and stuff like that. So I'll have to put a team together. So I do have to figure out who the DP will be. I have to figure out who, you know, I would love to take Jason Hoban back over there with me, but I doubt I can entice him. He's certainly going to do the sound design and Jeff will do the score. So of course you guys are completely welcome to come. We'd love to have you.
I'd love to go.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Great. This summer. I mean, here's the great thing. If you do go this summer, you guys, I mean, you'll be a part of this really big film festival. And Jason, you have not been to one film festival with us yet. So
not yet.
Better one to go to in Normandy.
That's a fair and valid point.
Also, Delta is chartering a flight to go over there for people on the team.
What? Let's do it. All right. I'll do it.
All right. You're in.
Wait. What does that mean?
So, you know, we're partnering with Delta. They are super excited about the film. They love supporting veterans. So they have decided to charter a flight from Atlanta to Deauville, which is in Normandy. It's not even Charles de Gaulle. So they're getting us all the way pretty far out. The night before, on March 31st, they're doing an honorary dinner to honor these World War II veterans. So we're partnering with the Best Defense Foundation, which is headed up by Donnie Edwards. And, you know, he's the one that's really sponsoring a lot of the veterans. So we're going to do a dinner on the 31st. And then we're going to fly over on June 1st. And Michael Strasberg, who's grandfather is in the film, will be one of the pilots because he works for Delta. So there's just a lot of chemistry. They may even fly Flo and Danny over early so Flo and Danny could fly back with all the veterans. So it's still all in the works. We're putting it together. Michelin is going to be one of the sponsors as well. So that brings in David Chapman. It's just going to be a super exciting time to be a part of this film and to be over in Normandy. And yeah, so love to have you guys with us.
But chartering a flight for the team doesn't mean you just show up and say, "Hey, I'm on the team," then you get on the plane. Is that
No. We'd have to deal with that in the early on. So make a decision now. Plus, you got to reserve places to stay, and we have access to those places, and can get them pretty inexpensively. But you have to make the decision, right around now. Reserve your place to stay and figure out, transportation. Like I've told people before, it's a 4-hour drive from Charles de Gaulle to Normandy. And so you usually leave in the evening and you land in the morning, and then you're tired. So do you want to drive 4 hours all the way out to Normandy? Not exactly. So you either choose to have somebody pick you up, or you spend a night in Paris or something like that. So it's just all sort of stuff you got to work out.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we shift gears to grueling glory. Sorry, I'm having a hard time speaking. Do you want to give a recap on?
Yeah, we'll just recap this real quick. It's a 9-minute, 52-second short. This was shot at the same time that The Girl Who Wore Freedom was. And it was written by Michelle Phoenix, who was our translator at the time. We had sent her on a mission to be part of the second unit team that filmed the Exodus March and the La Barquette March. And she was really a witness at this event. So she was really blown away by what she saw. This was early on in our time shooting. Just the love and the admiration that the French reenactors had for Tom Rice, who was a 101st Airborne veteran, who was, drove up in a Jeep to meet them and thank them and talk about his story. And so she wrote this blog post. I thought it would make a great little short. And I had talked to the team about kind of continuing to work to kind of keep our skills honed and, be able to be on the festival circuit. It'd give us another credit. If we were able to win awards, it would just be adding to our collection of awards as a team. We're young filmmakers and we're all wanting to, build up our resume and add to what we can do. And I thought this would be some low hanging fruit for us. But it did entail finding new footage. We used some from The Girl Who Wore Freedom, but we had to dig around and find new footage to go along with stuff. We needed a new score. And then Jason had to, make it all sound fabulous. Bill Ebel was supposed to be here today, but got pulled away for another thing. He could talk about sort of the editing behind that, and maybe we'll have him on another time. But Jeff, why don't you do a little bit of talking about the score and what you did to create that, and then we'll talk to Jason about how he kind of put everything together.
Yeah, I will say the process was different, much different and much faster than The Girl Who Wore Freedom, right? The Girl Who Wore Freedom was years in the making. And the actual, what you hear in the film from a music standpoint was also sort of years in the making. I mean, there was just so much iteration and process and just trying to find that voice of the music. And with Grueling Glory, maybe it was because it was a shorter, I'm sure that had to do a lot, right? It's a 10-minute film versus a 90-minute film. But there, I felt like on all fronts, Bill, Jason, myself, Christian, Michelle Phoenix, like, there was already this playground we were already playing in. I felt like I'm The Girl Who Wore Freedom, we had to find the playground first and then play in it. This film, because it's sort of cut from the same cloth as The Girl Who Wore Freedom, in a way, we already were familiar with that playground. And like Christian said, we had honed those skills. And so when it came to making this film, there wasn't a whole lot of back and forth with the music specifically. I remember turning it in and feeling like, okay, that's like draft one, and there might have been a few changes, and I was sort of like, so are we good? Like, is everyone happy with this? And everyone seemed to be fine with it. It was like, oh, okay, I guess we're done. So that process was much quicker, from my standpoint at least. Maybe Jason has different stories, but I remember feeling like, oh, is this, are we done? And then I felt like maybe they're not happy and they're just saying they're happy anyway. you know, you get all these, you get a lot of self-doubt and you think like, maybe they're just saying that's fine. And in the background, they've hired someone else. Well, so,
now, Jeff, I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head when you talked about we found the playground. We were already playing there. We already had a great idea of the feel of everything. And even though it was a different story, there were enough of similarities there, you know, where you could create something new and unique, but in the same ballpark. And
What I didn't want to do was repurpose the Girl Who Wore Freedom score. I didn't want to create a score that was like, you could not tell if it belonged in there or not. Now, I think there are some similarities, but I felt like it deserved its own sort of unique identity, because this film, if The Girl Who Wore Freedom is a photograph of history, I feel like this film is an impressionist painting of history, because what we get, Michelle Phoenix, her way of telling the story is, in my soul, I feel like it's more poetic than what Christian was filtering through her perspective, but it was still, she's telling a story of history and trying to bridge the gap of this love story. And Michelle Phoenix is very poetically and heartfelt, sort of giving her impressions of this man and this these reenactors and everything that she saw, and it comes out in a very beautiful, heartfelt, poetic way. And because of that, I felt like there was a little bit more, I don't know, these memories and these to try to encapsulate what we're seeing with all these reenactors, but also the words that she's saying are very evocative of these personal emotions that she's having. So I felt the score needed to be a little more tender until we get to the end, where we have these triumphant sort of moods because of the images we're seeing. And we're talking about, you know, kind of in a similar way, The Girl Who Wore Freedom ends up, we talk about remembering and, you know, keeping that spirit alive of freedom and love and compassion and all those things. But we hear specifically, just to dig in a couple nerd, I'm going to nerd out on a couple specifics. On this film, we hear a lot more woodwinds. I used like the oboe and the clarinet a lot more, just to kind of give these light sort of wispy ideas of memories, this sort of like haze that you have to kind of, you know, bat away a little bit to be able to see the film. And I feel like the woodwinds give a nice sort of floaty haze to the score. So I'm using a lot more woodwinds, whereas The Girl Who Wore Freedom, I use a lot more strings and brass. And in both scores, I use a lot of piano, because it's good when you don't have a live orchestra to lean on the piano. It's good because it's going to sound pretty good in the mix. It's not going to sound super fakey, whereas sometimes the computer samples of other instruments might be a little like, oh, that's not a real person. But with the piano, it's very forgiving. And I play piano, so it's very easy for me to express myself on piano. Anyway, I was trying to do more of this Thomas Newman effect style on this particular film, where I'm taking a three-note motif and sort of packaging it up in different harmonies. So the three notes we hear in the beginning of the film, it's more minor keyed and very sort of, it's not sorrowful, but it's, you know, there's a weight there and there's a heaviness. And because of the memory, and she's describing, you know, the frailty of the situation and of this person. And so it's a beautiful recountenance of her feelings. And then later I can package those same three notes in a more triumphant chordal setting and harmonic setting that we feel like it's all familiar material that we've heard throughout the film melodically, but now I can give it to you in a way that feels like, oh man, all right. Now I feel uplifted and like there's hope and joy and those kind of feelings, which we want to end on. So, so for me, that was kind of my approach. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done if it was a longer film, but I will say that the 10-minute thing felt really good from a package standpoint. I felt like I could just focus on one or two ideas musically and really just play with them. And that was a lot of fun to do. Whereas in a longer feature length film, you have a lot of time where you're just sort of doing pads and mood, and you don't really, you know, there's a lot of time to play with. And this is more compressed And I had to be really, poignant with my ideas to get them in and out.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, is there music throughout the whole thing with this one?
There is, I think, a very, I just watched it actually. And I felt like in the very beginning, either the music is really low intentionally, or I did drop out for a bit, but it is pretty much wall to wall music from what I could tell. But the nice thing is there's a lot of space in some of these moments of music, much like the Girl Who Wore Freedom, where we hear these chords and it sort of shifts slowly and there's space in there. But what we hear a lot in Grueling Glory is these kind of low percussion hits too. Right in the beginning of the film, we get this kind of like low bass drum and snare drum and these boom, boom, boom. And it kind of, these sort of distant war drum kind of feelings. That history echoing through the years kind of vibe of these military men. And that played a really important role as we have this footage from the reenactors or archival footage, being able to use the percussion in that way.
Yeah, I think too, you're right. There's a real difference between the way that Michelle Phoenix saw and wrote what she saw and what I did. Mine's much more of a cinema verite, personal discovery kind of experience. She's a writer. And so in her mind, she writes this very rich, woven together, well-written piece that she reads. So it is a very different film. I thought, as always, your music was very thoughtful and took that into consideration. It is a memory, it's a memory. And I thought you did a good job complimenting that. I do think it's very interesting that we did our feature and then we just did a short. Typically on these film festival circuits that I've been on, everybody does the short as proof of concept for the longer feature that they want to do. We'll do it backwards. Why not?
No reason to start being traditional now.
Exactly.
Yeah, I want to jump in and say that I approached this the same way, where the documentary, it exposed us to this event that's happening in Normandy and all throughout France. And so if you didn't know that this was happening, this is a great exposure. So this is great that it happens first. And then Michelle tells you the story on a, more poetic or romantic, as if, okay, you've learned about what's happening, and then you get to kind of be there emotionally through Michelle's writing. And when I watched it again today to be ready for the podcast, and I teared up, and because I got to see a lot of these events in person, and I just was able to go back there and feel those powerful moments. And that's how I approached the mix, the sound design, and the way that I treated the narration. And it wasn't like in the documentary where it was very realistic at times, it wasn't very dreamy like. And in the short, I was kind of trying to romanticize those moments as well and make it feel like something you're reflecting on as opposed to seeing for the first time.
So Jason, I don't remember, were you and Jeff, either one of you, at this event by any chance?
I wasn't with Michelle that day, but I do want to say at some point we crossed something. I do remember seeing all the soldiers march. I just, they cover quite a bit of ground, so I can't remember where, but.
I went to the bakery that's in the shot when they're marching through Carentan, but I was not there on the day that happened.
Yeah, I wasn't either. That's why I was asking. I wasn't there either. So the cameraman was Guillaume Lemezzo. We also had a drone operator there that day. I think we had Michelle and Flo Boucherie. I just didn't know if we had any sound there. So we were clearly doing something else, Jason. You were with me, and we must have been doing an interview or something, because I didn't remember this at all. So seeing the event through Michelle's eyes was really kind of cool. Just a different perspective. So, Jason, were there any challenges? I mean, I think you probably, again, what I loved when we were over in Normandy is you were recording jeeps and you were recording marching and boots and Did you use any of the stuff that you recorded in Normandy in this one as well?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's always my goal. I love to use, to bring that authentic quality to it. So yeah, I always try to use whatever I captured there. And Guy would, those guys always mic'd up their cameras. So they would throw on a 416 shotgun on there and they would be capturing audio. It just would have a, you know, a larger perspective, a further back or whatever. So, yeah, the Jeep, I remember using the Jeep sound effect when we kind of see, when we talk about Tom Rice rolling in, that's the actual Jeep. Cause we were, I was on that shot. I remember recording that, but then I took the same model, an actual recorded sound effect. And then I stylized that to kind of let it ring out throughout the spot to bring in that more like hyper realistic feel and add to the, like drown it out into the score. So it almost feels like a sound effect falls into that musical element. And so it's a mixture of both. But for the most part, like when you see everyone walking through the town and they're chanting and, you know, left, left, right, that's actual audio from the location.
Oh, that's cool. Well, what I think is interesting is we also didn't have the deadline craziness that we had for The Girl Who Wore Freedom. I mean, we truly were locked when we gave it to you, Jason. And it wasn't like you have to do give us this tomorrow. So was that a better experience?
Yeah, no, just even to go back to what Jeff said, it was a whole different process. It was not this tight turnaround kind of action that we were in before. It was something familiar that we'd done, and there was elements that kind of carried over that I used from the documentary into the short with Grueling Glory. So yeah, it was a much fun, it was an easygoing process, but yeah, it also helps that it's not 90 minutes.
I know, having a 10 minute film as opposed to a 90 minute film is like all the difference in the world. I mean, it really is like, you know, a sprint versus a marathon, you know, and it's just a different, I see why people do the short first. makes sense. You know, you kind of get that stuff worked out. We just did it backwards. We just did it the hard way.
We did it. And you know, it's, I, when I look at my edit session, when I look back at the film, I don't see like just a couple weeks. I see years of work at different time points. And I could just recall what that was, when it was, you know, what was happening then. And then when you look at Grueling Glory, it's just kind of like a snapshot. It's so small and it feels just like a whole different world. But yeah, it was, it's fun to look back on it both ways.
Yeah, for sure.
So what, if we get an update as to, you know, what Jeff and Jason, you guys are working on outside of Normandy projects?
Jason?
Sure. I started a business with my business partner, Mark Ruff. It was an engineer I worked with at Chicago Recording. We started our own thing. We started a remote studio. So that's kept us really busy. It's been a lot of fun. I do a lot of work with a company called Animated Storyboards, where we do animatics. I do a lot of short films for independent people. I do some podcasts. I do this podcast, and all kinds of different odds and ends. And I, you know, it's kind of great as I'm working with Jeff right now on a meditation series. So,
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
We've been keeping the band together here, in the background.
Hey, I feel left out. Isn't there something I can do?
Actually, you need to benefit from this meditation series, I think.
No kidding. That's for sure. I need that. Give me that.
I will. I'll share it with you. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, I try to keep busy with different projects, and it's great, yeah, when we can keep the band together, because we made so many great relationships. Like when you asked me to go, I just said yes instantly. I'm going to make it happen, because I know what I'm getting into, where before I couldn't imagine what it would be. And it was, even though it was crazy at times, it was some of the most memorable, meaningful moments I've had, and working with everyone along the lines. Yeah, we've made some lasting relationships.
Yeah. And I understand now, like when you look at Hollywood, and you look at how, you know, this person works with this person and they seem to do so much stuff together. Now I get it. I mean, I totally get it. Once you have been through this battle, right, and you've produced something, you make these intense, hopefully long-lasting creative partnerships. And we were very blessed, I think, to have that happen. You know, I feel like we're a really great team, and I do look forward to, you know, these other projects that we have coming online, just because I can't wait to work with you guys again.
Same.
Yeah, same. We agree. It'd be fun.
Jeff, what are you working on these days?
So I'm the audio director on a video game that's being made about, I don't know if you guys know the sci-fi show, The Expanse. It was on Sci-Fi, and now it's on Amazon. It's in its last season right now. Season 6 just is being released now. And so we're making, the company I work for is making a video game based on the series of books in the show, The Expanse. So I'm doing music for it and heading up the audio team for sound design and voiceover, and doing a couple other projects on nights and weekends. Obviously, like Jason just said, doing some stuff that comes his way when he needs it, and a couple other games that have come across my desk that I'm really excited to dive into. And then I spent most of the fall leading up to Christmas sort of arranging and producing this Christmas EP that I was really excited about. I got together with some friends, and so it's kind of these, I don't know, non-traditional arrangements of very traditional Christmas songs, and it was really fun. And so we I don't know if anyone else likes it, but we've been digging it, and we had a great time doing it. So I just trying to do, you know, stuff that, one, I got to pay the bills, but also trying to find more opportunities to, you know, do stuff that is fun, even if it doesn't make me any money. I still want to be expressing myself creatively somehow.
I hear you.
I have a question about the Expanse video game. I mean, obviously the show had music in it already. Mm-hmm. With the video game, are you asked to duplicate that? It sounds similar, or you use the same stuff?
Yeah, so they haven't asked us. Elcon is the people who have the rights to the show. And in an interesting twist, I was expecting them to say, you know, use the theme and use this this stuff from the show. But they, I guess, do not own the rights to the music for the show, which I think they would, but I guess it wasn't a work for hire agreement or something. So so they can't tell us, they don't have the authority to say, use this or use this theme. Even in the announcement trailer we just released in early December to announce that we were making the game. And when the title shows up at the end, I put the little the Expanse theme at the end, and they said, oh, you can't use that because we don't have the rights to it. So I was like, oh, in some ways that's kind of, oh, that's nice. I can put my own thumbprint on it. But to answer your question, there is a desire that fans of the show will feel at home in the game. So I am trying to make the music feel similar in a way. So I'm paying attention to, you know, the harmonic choices and the arrangements, but we do want to push the envelope in some ways.
That's interesting. So when's the game come out?
So we haven't announced a release date, but we just announced that we were working on it. But I will say we're pretty early in working on it. Okay. So we still got a little bit of time.
I don't know if I ever brought this up. I recruited a young woman to work with me, and her dad wanted to check out the company and everything. So he actually came in for the interview, which was interesting. And it turned out he is famous in the world of video soundtracks. He did the Halo soundtrack.
Oh, is this Marty O'Donnell?
What's his name again?
Marty O'Donnell?
I think that's it.
He also did like the Flintstones vitamin, didn't he?
I'm not aware of. This is a guy that would, you know, at Comic-Con type conventions, you know, for video games, like people come to get his autograph and pictures. And I'm not in that world, so I had no idea. I'm like, oh, that's cool. It's a whole other, I mean, that could be you, Jeff. You could be people wanting pictures and autographs because of the Expanse video game soundtrack.
It would be unbelievable. I don't see it happening, but it would be great.
But, you know, I do see people really engaged with you on Twitter about the Wildstar game. Apparently tons of people love.
Yes, they love that. I just shut down my Twitter account, but they do love.
Wait, Why did you do that?
I just couldn't take it. I would get so. I mean, this is a whole nother podcast. I would just get so depressed and so emotionally unstable by going on Twitter. I felt like for my mental health, I just had to like stop. Because
I just want to applaud you. I'm applauding Jeff.
Comparison is the thief of joy, is what I'm told, and I just could not get over that hump. Some people handle it really well.
Let's just say that one more time. Comparison is the thief of joy. I like that. Yes. So true. It's
been worded, I think, different ways, but my wife has told me that for years, and it's so true. I go on Twitter and I see everything that people are doing that I'm not doing, and then I just am depressed for like a week, and I feel like it's just not healthy. Anyway, so the WildStar soundtrack had definitely a sort of a cult following. Even the people, not just the soundtrack, but the game itself had a cult following, not enough of a following to keep it up and running, unfortunately. But it's that's been a huge, I don't know, source of inspiration, I guess, for me, is when people who love that soundtrack will reach out or just say, you know, how much they loved it. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Very cool. All right. Well, very exciting stuff. So the short film, Christian, what else do we need to talk about? Grueling Glory, anything else?
Well, it is, we haven't had any acceptances this week. We just to review, we've had 5 acceptances, we've had 5 rejections, but one of our acceptances is the Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest, and we are nominated for the Best Documentary Short. And I decided this week to accept their invitation to come in person, so I'm going to be going January 27th through the 31st. They're showing it on the night of the 28th and the night of the 30th. So I'm really looking forward to that. If you're listening to this and you happen to be near Polson, Montana, come say hi. So we're just kind of seeing what happens next with that. I do want to move into our new segment called, you know, some of our favorite documentaries, remember?
Are we in on this?
Yeah. I mean, you know,
did you come prepared?
No, I didn't.
I'm going to give you a second because I'll talk about one of my very favorite ones. And then if you guys come up with one, you can chime in. But I am addicted to the Frank Sinatra All or Nothing at All documentary. And I don't know what my problem is, but I watch it all the time. And I think they're 2 or 3. It's probably only 2. Like, they're like 2 hours long. Like, each episode is like 2 hours long, and I will just watch it. I've watched it through just sitting there watching it as a movie several times, but now I just put it on in the background and listen to it. And I think it's that I love that era. I love the mid-century. I mean, I'm designing my whole new office in the basement in the mid-century modern theme. I'm just obsessed with that style. I love the music. His life is fascinating, but it's told, the story is told so well. And, you know, I'm amazed at sort of how the filmmakers pieced together. They went back and looked at all of his interviews and everything from when he spoke at colleges, from when he spoke on, you know, different shows. His mother and father had been interviewed at one point by the phone. They interviewed his son and his daughters. And I mean, they cover everything, and most all of it is in his own words or the words of his family. And then there's a lot of other people interviewed too, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., blah, blah, blah. And you understand what a complicated figure this man is. And it all began because at some point he did an early retirement in the 70s, and he put together a whole set list, and he began with the songs that sort of, you know, moved through his career. And the first one is All or Nothing at All. That was his very first song. And so they kind of use his set list that he made during that to tell his story all the way through the film. So, so that's one of the top ones on my list. Who wants to go next?
I saw that, by the way. Yeah, it was very good.
You thought it was good too?
Yeah. And I'm not even a huge Sinatra fan, so.
How'd you like the music?
I mean, it sounded like Frank.
I'll say something real quick. This is not a documentary, but it's based on a true story. It's the HBO Max limited series Landscapers.
I've not heard of this.
It's about a married couple who are found. They tell you up front they're in jail right now for murdering her parents, and they to this day claim their innocence. But they tell a story, and it is so creative because it's a mixture of drama and comedy. They break the fourth wall, and it goes from being a film to being very much like a play. And the actors are like, well, stage scenes, like they're doing a flashback. Well, this is what happened. Well, no, go over there, stand over there. Like, you know, it totally weaves in and out of these worlds of reenactment and play, talking to the audience, a serious crime drama. So creative. The actors are phenomenal. Landscapers. I'm only halfway through it and I can't get enough of it.
That's awesome. All right, you're up, Jason.
I just finished, and I'm not sure if I believe it's a documentary, Get Back, the Beatles documentary on Disney Plus.
Is it good? It's on my list.
It's amazing. I wish I was more prepared to give everyone credit that made this happen. Peter Jackson's behind it. The Beatles had stopped touring for like 2 years at this point in the documentary. So they're getting back together, putting some music together. They were going to do a TV show and just... So that they're tracking all of this and they're following this all on along with the Beatles, and you can see them working on music and trying to pull off this type of performance. I don't want to say too much if you haven't seen it, but it gives you like a really good insight into the band. You get to see them for who they are. You get to see what it was like for them to work on music together, and it's just it's amazing. And when you talk about sound engineers and recording engineers, you get to see all of those people around with the band. So you can kind of see how much it takes to make something like this possible. And you get to see those other talents. You get to see, you know, them thinking about mic position and technical things. And back in the late 60s, right? So this was a whole different era, 70s. And yeah, I get to see some of, like, George Martin is one of my heroes. I just, what he was able to accomplish with the Beatles is amazing. So you get to just actually see their personalities and who they are. And it's great. The episodes are pretty long, but you get this kind of, you get to hear what some of your favorite Beatles songs sounded like before they were finished.
That is awesome. That's cool. That's awesome.
Have you watched That 3-2-1 on Hulu with Paul McCartney and Rick Rubin? Jason?
No, I have not.
Oh, you would like that too. They're basically Rick Rubin, who is one of my heroes. He, a producer, he and Paul McCartney sit down and they go through songs and they have the masters there. So they bring up the bass track or they bring up the vocal and they really start. And Paul McCartney will say, oh, I was trying to do this on the bass, or I really was influenced by it. It's pretty fascinating. Again, I'm not a big Beatles guy, much like Frank Sinatra, but I thought it was great. So you would like it.
So what is that one called?
I think it's called McCartney 3-2-1.
Interesting.
I'll check it out.
That's on Hulu.
Well, since we're throwing out bands, one of my all-time favorite one was the documentary about the Go-Go's. Jeff and I have talked about this before.
That sounded great. I was in a coffee shop, but I'm sure it was amazing.
Jeff and I were supposed to go together. and so we had it all planned out. We were going to go together and we drove over there. We're going to park the car and run in. And of course, you know, the Sundance, we can't park the car. So Jeff kindly let me go in. I got to meet and talk with the Go-Go's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the Beatles. That was a magical thing. It was phenomenal. It was a great documentary. Soundtrack of my senior year. So.
That's awesome. Right. So I, if you don't, if you want to,
go ahead.
Okay. Because I don't have to. I don't know if these are my favorites, but recent ones. I will say one of my favorites in recent years was the documentary on Muscle Shoals. And I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Alabama.
Yeah. So the Muscle Shoals is like the place for like hit making records back in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, and so, yeah, I heard about this.
Yeah. It's great. When you talk about that swamp sound and how they got it, and all this black music was played by all these white people. And it was just so fascinating about how they got that sound and what was so special about that time and that place. And people from all over the world wanted to come and record there. So very, very interesting and fascinating. And then I recently saw on HBO the one about the making of Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette one. And that was a fascinating documentary as well. That was one of my favorite albums when I was in high school. And not also in the, like Josh had, not a documentary, but a true story. Worth with Michael Keaton, where they have to figure out the value of lives after 9/11.
I've seen that on Netflix, and I don't know. A, his accent's terrible. So I'm like, I don't want to watch that. And yeah. Then that's just on the trailer.
I have no idea how much of it's true, but I thought it was an interesting, I didn't know that was going on, you know, and it's interesting that some people had to sit down and figure that out.
Yeah, that's pretty deep. It's basically, how do you figure out what a life was worth during 9/11, right?
Yeah, so they have to convince people to not sue the airlines, otherwise it would cripple the economy. And so instead they have to convince people to take part of this victims fund, where the government will distribute money, and they have to assign how much each victim's family would get. And so what's the math on that? And it's, if you don't, you know, and then your goal is to try to get them to not sue. I thought the premise of it was good. It may not even be close to how it went down, but they're apparently portraying real people in real scenarios.
Josh, I'm surprised you didn't bring up My Date with Drew.
Well, oh, that's a good one.
We gotta look, we just listed 10. We gotta space these out. We're gonna run out of documentaries this segment. So I say we cut it off here. 8 is enough for one episode. And we'll mention one or two next time.
throw people together who love documentaries. Oh, and you know, you're here for a while.
Don't even get me started about McMillions. Man.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
I want to say thanks for listening to Documentary First. Before I say that though, I want to say thanks to Jeff Kurtnacker for being on, and Jason Hoban, thanks for being here. Yeah, Christian Taylor is really going to need some of that meditation therapy you guys are working on. So to her quick. I'm going to close it.
Everyone.
Christian, you got something quick you need to say? Because I'm about to wrap this puppy up.
Nope. I thank you guys for listening. Patreon people, thank you for donating. You're keeping us in business, and we really appreciate it. So keep listening and keep donating. It means a lot.
All right. Yes. Thank you for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everyone has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it.
Yes, you can. Bye, everybody.